So where are we up to? We are in Parshat Va'era. Parshat Va'era is every kid who goes to school knows that there are seven makot in Va'era and that there are three in Parshat Bo. And the way they remember this is that the first two letters of Va'era, Vav and Aleph, 6 + 1 = 7, and the first two letters of Parshat Bo, Bet and Aleph, equals 3, and that's how they all remember. If you didn't know this, or you think that's the most wonderful thing you've ever heard, so then I apologize for all your former educators. To understand where we're up to, the plagues are going to come, but there's also a preamble to plagues. So the preamble are the other signs and wonders which take place, which means there's really two aspects to the plagues. One aspect of the plagues is that it shows Moshe and Aaron, and then by extension, God's superiority over anything that Egypt sees, believes, understands, can do, and so on. So we have a type of a battle going back and forth, and this battle is going to be won by God. I just want to point out how early that's going to be very obvious. But then aside from the signs and the wonders and the incredibleness of this, which shows the superiority, aside from this, we have the element of punishment which is taking place. And the element of punishment is significant, because from the very beginning we're told about both of those things. Along the way, some of us are going to be troubled by the perceived problem of the, is it fair that God gives these punishments? Is it fair that Paro's heart is hardened? And as I said, that's also introduced along the way, but I don't think that's the major problem, although, again, we recognize that it's there. Going back to source number 1, which is Perek Dalet, Vayomer Hashem el Aharon, Lech Lekrat Moshe Midbar, Vayelech Vifcheshehu Bahar Elokim, Vayishaklo. So the two brothers meet up at Har Sinai. So that for us should be something which is very significant, because we all know that Har Sinai is an important place, and Har Sinai is where something else very significant is going to happen some point along the way. So for the meantime, Moshe has somehow wandered out there. And let's just give that a little bit more thought. Moshe at this point is a shepherd. I don't believe his choice of shepherding is incidental. I don't believe it was simply because he needed to find a job. Right? He was brought up in aristocracy. He didn't have any kind of training, and he didn't know what can he do. So he ends up a shepherd. I think being a shepherd is as significant as him going to Har Elokim. Har Elokim, that's what it's called, the mountain of God. So you can all tell me, and I'm willing to accept it, it's called the mountain of God because of what's going to happen afterwards. But nonetheless, it's as if by a magnet, Moshe is being pulled by this Kedusha. He's being pulled by this place which is holy. He's being pulled to this place where the bush is burning, of course called the Sneh, which the Midrash says that the word Sinai comes from the word Sneh. And therefore, over here, Moshe is attracted to this place which is holy. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is just the background of being brought up in Egypt. And in Egypt, along the way in the Yosef narrative, we're told that the most detestable thing for the Egyptians is being a shepherd. So now Moshe, as part of his being a Baal Tshuva, you know, Baal Tshuva is always extreme. I shouldn't say this, right? I don't even like the word, I don't like the term Baal Tshuva. I think they should be called Nouveau Frum. I think that's much, I think that works much better. But sometimes someone who is a Baal Tshuva, somebody who's changed, they need to become very, very authentic in their Judaism. But no, they need it's authentic. They need authenticity, which Moshe perhaps is seeking this authenticity. He's going back to the basics. He's going back to what the tribes did. He's going back to the life which was a more simple life of being a shepherd, but that's very significant. Because when Moshe ends up standing in front of God, and then God says to him, what's in your hand, and his staff in his hands, and throws it to the ground, and the staff becomes a snake, a serpent, a nachash. And Moshe recoils, he's afraid. And that to me is very strange, because shepherds take care of snakes, they eat them for breakfast. I mean that figuratively, not literally. But I mean, they're out in the wild. They're used to these things. But when Moshe is in front of the snake, he throws it down. The word is that it becomes a nachash. And that's very significant because I think the nachash there is related, and what scares Moshe is not that he's scared of snakes. I think that he sees something much more in terms of its spiritual sense. And the last time around we had serpents or snakes, it didn't work out all that well. And serpents represent sin, and snakes represent sin. And here we have our Baal Tshuva Moshe looking down at this serpent, looking down at sin, looking down at temptation, and that's something which is quite frightening. And then God says to him, and you'll notice I'm interpreting everything now symbolically, which is what we'll be doing a lot of today. And God says, put your hand down and hold it. And then he turns it back into a stick. And that's incredible, because we're standing at Har Sinai. And let's just go back for a second and quote a Gemara. None of this is here. Let's quote a Gemara. The Gemara says that if you meet up with the Yetzer Hara, what do? You drag that wretch into the Beit Midrash, because the Torah is the Tavlin. The Torah is the antidote for the Yetzer Hara. That's exactly what takes place over here. Where are we standing? We're standing at Sinai. So we're standing at Sinai. Even back in Eden, there were two trees. There was the Eitz Hadat and Eitz Chaim. Eitz Chaim is Torah. Eitz Chaim mila machzikim ba. The Eitz Chaim is Torah. I mean, the biggest question that I have, which actually proves that Adam wasn't Jewish, is why in the world does he eat from the Eitz Hadat Tovarah? Because it says the day you eat from it, you're going to die. If he was Jewish, he would have eaten from the Eitz Chaim first and lived forever. Get out of jail card, put it in your pocket, and then you can do whatever you want. What kind of insanity is this? A goyish cup. I'm sorry. I apologize for everything I said and everything I'm going to say. Okay, and I will say. But no, I'm saying, just think about it a second. By the way, that's temptation. That's the serpent. That's the nachash. If you want, that's Freud. It's a death wish. It's insanity, but we love insanity. We're enthralled by insanity. So Adam, or Eve and Adam, we have to give Eve credit as well. We don't want to leave her out of this, else I'll get yelled at, right, Julie? So Eve sees the temptation and leads Adam towards the same temptation, but all that comes to the Nachash. So Moshe is standing here, but something really significant happened. What is he told? You can control that Nachash. You can control that temptation. Why? Because he's standing here by Har Sinai, by Har Elokim. He's standing over here by the Eitz HaChayim. He's standing here by Torah. And God is telling him that I am going to give you something which can then defeat and control this Yetzer Hara, and that is Torah, and that's a whole new world. And when Moshe goes and he meets the people, presumably he shows them this same thing. And let's now read this again from the first source. Aaron comes and meets him by Har Elokim. V'yaged Moshe la'Aaron. And he shows him all of these things as well, presumably also our old staff into snake trick. Now also pay attention that the staff has a symbol. You haven't been paying attention to it. But the staff symbol on its most basic level is the tool of the trade of the shepherd. This is the shepherd's staff. So as a shepherd's staff, it means something. Just pause there for a second. But it would also mean something because the shepherd is a representation of what the Jews do. So this now became a Jewish symbol, much the way that any kind of Jewish symbol you can think of today, be it a yarmulke, be it a talis, be it whatever it may be, as a Jewish symbol, that is a Jewish symbol. So over here we have this meeting point between this Jewish symbol and temptation, and the Jewish symbol is going to win, and that is, again, more or less what we've had so far, and that's what he shows him. Vayelech Moshe v'Aaron v'yosfu et kol ziknei b'nei Yisrael, v'yedaber Aaron et kol dvar Moshe diber Hashem el Moshe, v'yasa otot l'nei ha'am. So now he does the same thing, and he shows it to the people. So now the same sign so far that God showed Moshe, Moshe reports to Aaron. Aaron then shows it to the people, and all of this till this point is exactly the same. What's the response in Lamed Aleph? V'yamein ha'am, v'yishma'u ki pagad Hashem et b'nei Yisrael, v'chi ra'ot anyam v'yikdu v'yishtachavu. Jubilation, belief, ecstasy, the Exodus is going to begin. Continue. Of course, afterwards, Moshe then goes to Paro. The various elders that were supposed to accompany them didn't really make it. They sort of disappeared along the way. Source 2. V'achar bo Moshe v'Aaron v'yomel paro ko amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael. And notice this issue about which name to use, it was a conversation. Right away when God said to Moshe, go, this is what we skipped back in Perek Gimel, who should I say is calling? Who should I say sent? What name should I report? So over here it's very specific because Paro is going to question this. Ko amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael shlach et ami v'yachogu li b'midbar. Moshe and Aaron say, God, the God of Israel, said, release my people and let them celebrate or worship me in the desert. V'yomer Paro mi Hashem asher shma b'kolo. Who, I don't know how disdainful you want this to be, but again, notice the name which is being used over here is Yud-Kei-Vav, okay? Who is this God? It wasn't that Paro was unaware of gods. I mean, there were many gods in Egypt. I've told you before, the biggest challenge to understand the Makot is to understand how they fit within Egyptian mythology. But the problem with Egyptian mythology is there's so many different gods, you will get many false positives along the line when you try to say, oh, this must be that, because there are so many gods. You can close your eyes and throw a dart and you're going to hit a god in Egypt. There's just all over the place. There are gods. So over here, who's this god? This is what I've never heard of. And as far as we're concerned, who is this God? What does he say? This is Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, Ha-Yahovah-Bi-Yeh. This is the transcendent God, creator, sustainer of the universe. And Paro's response, of course, is, Mi Hashem Asher Eshmar B'Kolo, who is this God? Or who is God that I should listen to him? L'Shalach Yisrael. Lo Yadati Et Hashem. I'm not familiar with God. The Gami Yisrael lo shalach, and therefore, of course, the result is I'm not going to send them away. Vayomru Elohei Avrim Nekroi Leinu. And over here they switched a little bit and they say, this is the God of the Jews, the God of the Hebrews. Called us. Nelchona Derech Shloshi Yamim B'Midbar V'Nizbacha LaHashem. Again, they very specific. And we're going to go and we're going to serve God, Yudke Vavke, Hashem Elokeinu, Pen Yivke'enu B'Dever U'Becherev. Lest you start to get, well, for lack of better terms right now, we will call them makot, right? So there is not a veiled warning over here. There is a nice warning over here. And what's Paro's response? You are bothering these people. You're getting their hopes up. They're going to think that they're leaving. They're not going anywhere. And you'll also notice, and we're not going to deal with this, that all that was on the table at this point was 3 days. They're not going to go for the 3 days. They're not going to go for full freedom. And they're not going to recognize God whatsoever. Basically, you're going to be causing more problems. And that's what happens next. When Paro increases the workload. And what we have, just in case all of you today would love to believe, like certain people believe, that once a process of redemption begins, then it's the trajectory is such where it goes completely, you know, straight up or this way. But what we see over here is hills and valleys, and we see that things go up and things go down. We eventually get there, but there are setbacks along the way. And I don't know why someone would think that the future redemption, which is based upon the previous redemption, should have any other type of trajectory. So we're skipping through some of the valleys, and we're going straight to source 3, which is Perek Zayin. Vayomer Shem Moshe Ro'ein Etaticha Elohim LaParo, which of course is quite interesting. Paro doesn't recognize God, so he says, I'm going to make you into, now I don't know how you want to pronounce this word. You want to pronounce it Elohim or Elohim? You want to pronounce it as a God with a capital G or a power or something of the like. I'm going to make you an Elohim LaParo v'Aron Chichiyeh Neviecha, which means I'm about to make you something that the self-styled God Paro, because he himself, he's many gods, by the way. He's God of the Nile. He's also the sun god. That's the easiest one to connect and probably the most important one. And you are going to now show your superiority over him. And Moshe along the way will constantly say, I'm just doing this for God. So therefore, compared to Paro, you will be like a god. Compared to Paro, who thinks he's a god, you will be like a god, meaning you will be far more powerful than Paro will. But he also sets up an interesting relationship, which we thought earlier was just b'di'evad, because Moshe keeps complaining that he can't speak. Okay, you can't speak, I'll give you a speaker. But now he's saying, I'm going to make you into this thing of power, and you will now have Aaron to be your prophet, as it were, which is exactly the words used here. Again, if you're not clear, Re'ena taticha Elohim l'paro, v'aron uchichi enevi'echa. You will be far more powerful than Paro, especially what he claims to be, and Aaron will be your emissary and your speaker. But Neviyacha is quite a good word, unless you want to say Navi is from Niv Sfatecha, and therefore someone who speaks. Atad deber et kol asher atzaveh, v'aron uchichi deber el Paro, v'shilach pnei Yisrael mi'artzo. and I hope that you like along the way, and this will work. Although that was Pasuk Bet. This is not the first time it's done this. It happened back before as well. But, v'niyakshet leif paro, but I'm going to harden his heart. And it seems to be that the reason for hardening the heart is exactly what it says over here, and that is in order to increase all the signs and wonders. That means these signs and wonders need to take place. So just to once again deal with this and push this out of the way, it was already raised in the Midrash between Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish, where Rav Yochanan says, oh no, if people see this, they're going to lose faith because they're going to say that everything is predetermined and it doesn't make a difference what we do. And Reish Lakish said, what are you talking about? He says, because he hardened the heart. And Reish Lakish responds back, and again, interesting, that Tzaddik, Rav Yochanan, and the Baal Tshuva, Reish Lakish, and Reish Lakish says, what are you talking about? Read the text carefully, and you'll see that for the first five plagues, it says there that Paro hardens his own heart. Mm-hmm. It's only after the first five that his heart is hardened. So the Rambam follows Reish Lakish and says, well, that's punishment. You don't listen, one, two, three, four, five, six, five. So then you start getting punished. And so the punishment is that you can no longer get out of the way, because otherwise, you know, he does all this bad, ignores God, right? And he deserves punishment. So he doesn't want him to be able to avoid the punishment at this point. But the most elegant interpretation is the one which is offered by the Sforno. The Sforno says that the thing which took away Paro's free will was actually the Makot. This is called behavior modification. You keep smacking somebody, they're going to change their behavior. So the Makot is what took away the free will, and God hardening Paro's heart returned his free will and let him do exactly what it was that he wanted to do, and that was hold on to the Jews, which means it's the most elegant interpretation because it just turned the question into the answer. How can he harden his heart in order to give him free will? Yes? Very, very good. That's all that you need to know from today. But we've said that before, so we need to move on. Pasuk Dalid, v'lo yishma leichem paro. He's not going to listen to you. But he says he will listen, but he won't listen. He won't listen initially. V'lo yishma leichem paro, v'natati et yadi b'mitrayim. That's very important. God over here says, I am going to strike him with my hand. We're going to come back to the hand as we continue. V'natati et yadi b'mitrayim. That doesn't sound good, right? That does not sound good. I know it's an anthropomorphism. You don't have to tell me this. I know it's an anthropomorphism, but it's not good. I'm going to take them out. So again, mountains and valleys, punishments, Paro being intransigent, Paro backing down. He doesn't want to let them go, but he's going to get punished. He's going to suffer. His hardening of his heart is going to cause him to more and more and more suffering along the way. But there's another thing that happens along the way, and that's what I mentioned from the beginning, is then God gets to show off. At least in this context, is very significant, because the people need to see this. The people need to see the power of God as well. So let's continue. And the phrase again is used, my hand will be stretched out over Egypt. Skipping a little bit, Pasuk Chet, Vayomer Hashem Moshe v'Aharon Lemor, again he speaks, God speaks, Ki daber aleichem Paro lemor tnun lanu mofet. When Paro says, give us a sign, so here God is helping them, saying, okay, this is how it's going to go down. Paro is going to ask you for a sign. For Marta el Aaron, kachet matcha, Aaron, take your staff. So whose staff is this? Is this Moshe's staff or Aaron's staff? So follow the staff so you don't get confused. Take your kachet matcha. It's written in a deliberately ambiguous way, but I do believe this is Aaron's staff, but we'll continue. V'hashleich lefnei Paro, and he's going to throw it down in front of Paro, yihi litanin, and it will become a crocodile. Now, Rashi will tell you that the tanin and the nachash are the same. So this is Rashi theory, conservation of reptiles, that basically these are all the same. It does go back to Eden, because one of the things in Gan Eden was that the serpent, we're told, lost its legs. So what was a serpent before it lost its legs? Maybe it was a crocodile, so therefore... Excuse me?
A dragon.
A dragon. A dragon. So Rashi seems to be combining these two things, the Nachash and the Tanin, as one. But I want to pause and to try to say what I think may be pshat over here. I already told you my imagined pshat when it came to the snake. The snake has significance. But here's a different question. What exactly is the significance of the crocodile, and not to us? I mean, you maybe were brought up on Peter Pan or such things, and yeah. But what is the significance of the crocodile when it comes to Egypt? Which means not what do we see, but what did they see? So one of the signs of the power of Egypt is the crocodile. The crocodile is a sign of power. The Navi in Yechezkel, and it's a very important verse for multiple reasons, it says that Ben Adam, Yinabe, go and prophesy regarding Paro Melech Mitzrayim, or Melech Mitzrayim, and say to him, I'm on to you, king of Egypt, Hatanim HaGadol, the great crocodile, Tanim HaGadol, the great crocodile, Harovetz B'toch Ne'arav, who slithers around in his river, Asher Omar, who says, Li Ori Vani Asitini, the river is mine and I created it. So in this one verse, we actually understand multiple sides. One thing that I am convinced is that the more that we know of Egyptian mythology, the more we'll understand about what's taking place over here. But I want to go back to our verse in Yechezkel. Verse in Yechezkel combined two things. It combined the Nile as a life force, and you now just have to ask yourself a question. So how many of these plagues were somehow or other connected to the Nile, connected to water? And what was the significance to them? You know, for us, the Nile turning into blood was a real simple thing. Okay, now it's annoying, right? Annoying, because where am I going to get water from? Right? So it's just an annoyance. So the bottled water companies probably, you know, were making a lot of money at that stage by sending water down from the Golan. May Eden, that you get, my sister gets out of her, this up north, gets out of her tap. May Eden. Yeah. So it's an annoyance. And if you love the Midrashim, then it was even the water in the cups and so on and so forth. And if a Jew drank from half the cup with a straw and an Egyptian the other half, it was even divided, even though there's no evidence of that in the text at this point. Only later on we'll hear about the differences between the Egyptians and the Jews. But that's all of this comes from a perspective that we look at it as an annoyance. Where are we going to find water from? For the Egyptians, that wasn't just an annoyance. The Nile is a life force. The Nile is alive. Paro is the god of the Nile. The Nile bleeding means that in their minds, somebody came and stabbed the Nile repeatedly, and it's bleeding. The Nile is dying. For them, that is so much more significant than the way that we're looking at it. Oh, where are we going to get water from? I'm saying that's why you do have to wrap your minds around the mythology. But continue along those lines. In that same verse in Yechezkel, it calls Paro Hatanim HaGadol. It calls him this great crocodile, because that was part of the symbol of Egypt. That was the power of Egypt. It's a powerful, frightening animal. And that's how the Paro sees himself. So now, when Aaron takes his staff and he throws it to the ground, and it turns into a crocodile, into a tanim, that's not just a coincidence. That's just, oh, he's doing his old reptile trick. Snakes, crocodiles, who cares? That's incredibly significant, that this is now a crocodile. So what do? Crocodiles is their thing. So they also take sticks and throws it around, but I want to say it again. Aaron's stick, Aaron's mateh, which those of you who are going to track this all the way down to the Chad Gadya, is the chutra. Every time is the chutra, that's the stick, the chutra. Every time it talks about the staff, the Aramaic in the Targum is the chutra. So when he throws his shepherd's staff to the ground and it becomes a crocodile, and they then produce a bunch of little crocodiles, let's continue reading, because this is far more exciting than you imagined. Pasuk Yud, V'yavo Moshe v'Aaron oparo v'yesu ken ka'asher tziva Hashem v'yeshlech Aaron et matehu. It's Aaron's staff. Matehu, if you weren't sure. Lefnei Paro, Lefnei Avada, V'yihil Tanin. And it became a crocodile. V'yikur gam Paro l'chachamim l'machshafim v'yisu gam heim chartumei Mitzrayim b'lateim kain. They also somehow were able to replicate this and to produce crocodiles. V'yishlichu ish Matehu v'yihil Tanin v'yivla Mateh Aharon et Matotam. Now that's a very interesting end of the verse, because it doesn't say that his crocodile swallowed their crocodiles. It says that his staff swallowed theirs. Now, staffs don't have mouths necessarily, so that's far more. Now, again, if you want to insist and tell me that it really means that his crocodile swallowed theirs, I'm fine with that. It's just not what it says. And you sometimes have to pay attention to what it says. Because what just now happened, the sign of the Jews, of the shepherd, just now swallowed the sign and the symbol of Egypt, which was reverted, converted back into wood, and then swallowed up by the Jews. Do you understand what I just now said? I probably should end the class right now. Do you understand what I just now said? Egypt, they all revert back to wood, apparently. So part of what Aaron then does, apparently, again, it doesn't say it, apparently what it does, is that he's standing there and they all return back to wood. Egypt just disappeared, because the symbol of Egypt is the crocodile, it's gone. And then the staff of the shepherd swallows up. So you have a two-stage. You have conversion, and then, what's the second word you want? Do you want destruction? Which means you are going to abandon your belief system. You're going to stop believing in all this. You're going to believe what we believe in, and then you're going to disappear. How is all, you like all that? You remember to say this by the Seder? I didn't get it till 2 days ago. I don't know how they got it. But to answer your question, I think that whenever it comes to symbols of Egypt, I think they got it very, very strongly. People thought in symbols. People see things in terms of the symbols. Rashi saying the Nachash and the Tanim—it's all the same. I can't accept that because they're just too. They mean two different things in terms of the biblical symbolism till this point. And therefore, what just now happened is theologically breathtaking, what just now happened, because Paro was already just now told, all of Egypt is going to lose their belief in what you believe in, they're going to turn their belief over to the belief of the Jews, and they're going to be swallowed up and destroyed. Right? You like how I got all that from this one verse?
Yeah.
The snake, I think, goes back to the Garden of Eden, which is symbol sin. The crocodile is one of the symbols of Egypt, as we find later on. Correct. And only in conversation with Moshe, standing at Sinai, is the serpent something which is significant. At this point, if Paro was able to process, see, sometimes you can't. You can see all the signs on the wall. But if Paro was able to process what he just now saw, he should have known that he was just now already given all the signs and all the wonders that he needs. It's over. But of course, Paro can't do this. He has too much invested in this. How can he turn around and possibly say right now, you know what, you're right, I may as well just, fine, go. Go for 3 days, go for 3 months, go for 3 years, take a little time off. You guys can use a little vacation. Why don't you go down? You know, the Sinai is beautiful this time of year. Enjoy yourselves. But he can't do that. So even though Aaron just now won, so let's look at it again. Vayivla mate Aharon et matotam, Aaron's staff swallowed their staffs. Vayichsak lev paolo v'lo shema lehem kasher diber Hashem. So again, this is a separate philosophical or theological problem. Hold it. God said what he's going to do. Well, that's Rabbi Akiva in Pirkei Avot. Akol tzavoi v'rishut netuna. God sees, he knows what he's going to do. This is nothing to do with free will. Just God happens to exist outside of time and knows what it is that we choose. Yudalid. Vayomer Shema Moshe. Kaved leif paro me'in l'shalach ha'am. That Paro is a little stubborn and Paro refuses to send the people. Lechel paro, the first, fourth, and the seventh. Right? When Yehuda put them into Simanim, yes? So you put them into Simanim, the first, fourth, and the seventh are all lech. The second, fifth, and eighth are all bow. The second one in each group. When you take the makot, I'll try this again. Rabbi Yehuda says you take the makot, you divide them into groups of three. So when you divide into groups of three, what do you then do with that? Okay, that's easy to remember, except I don't remember what that was. So when you put them in groups of three, you then can do this in two directions. You can do this down, you can do this across. So it's 1, 2, 3. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then it's 1, 4, 7, 2, 5, 8, right? So now, what did that just now do for you? The first one, every single time, the first of each set is going to be lech, go. And that's always going to be go down to the Nile, go down to where Paro, to the Nile, and then we know the Nile is significant. The second one is going to be bow is always going to be go to the palace, go to where he lives. Right, go down to the Nile, come to where he lives, and the third one in each set will always be no warning whatsoever. So the first one is going to be deal with him there in terms of outside general world. Second one is going to be in terms of inside, which would be much more in terms of possessions. The third one will always be much more personal. So again, dam tzvadei akinim. Dam is going to be the Nile turned into dam. That's outside, that's public. Tzvadei is going to come into the houses. And that's going to affect them in a much more personal. But there it's lechem, here it's bo. There it's outside, here it's inside. And when it gets to kinim is going to affect the bodies themselves. That's the punishment for ignoring the first two. And that will be repeated then in the next set, and then again in the next set. Good? Wow. Rabbi Yehuda, it's in the Haggadah. It says, Rabbi Yehuda, Tanut Simonim, Datsach, Adashen. I don't know. I'm just drinking the wine. I'm sorry. Okay. Continue. So now, it was Lech, yes? We were up to Lech. Tedvav, Lech el paro baboker. Hine yotzei hamayma. By the fourth, it says the exact same thing. Seventh. By the seventh, it only says babo. It doesn't, it says Lech baboker, but it didn't say the word Nile at that point. But the rest of the form is the same. Lech el paro baboker. Hine yotzei hamayma. V'nitzavte lekroto. Al sfat hayor. V'amate asher nehapach l'nachash. Tikach b'yadecha. So it's very interesting. Moshe is to take his staff, which turned into the Nachash. So I'm saying this is not the same as what we saw a couple moments ago. But again, that's part of what Rashi's motivation is, theory of conservation of reptiles, that all of them are the same, just in order to avoid anything else. But Vamarta Elav Hashem Elokei HaIvrim, again, same introduction, Shalachani Elecha. Lemor shalachet ami vayavduni b'midbar v'nilo shamata adko. Send them, and you've not been behaving very nicely, Paro. Ko amar Hashem v'zot teda ki ani Hashem. And here you'll know that I am God. Yud kevav kai, I am God. Hinei nochi makeh b'mateh asher b'yadi al hamayim asher b'yor v'nevchu l'dam. That this staff is going to touch this thing, and it's going to turn to blood. V'dagah asher b'yor tamut, and so on and so forth. And that's what happens. They're able to replicate this, which to me is quite amusing. There's not enough water as it is, so let's turn some more water into blood. So again, they're not impressed. But I have to say this. If the first one, which wasn't a plague yet, was simply a message, the message was, Egypt will disappear and Egypt will be swallowed up. And the second message is, this God that you believe in is now stabbed and bleeding and dying. So the fact that he's able to get a little bit more blood suddenly calms him down. So I'll say this is not clear rational thinking. Okay? Well, you can say none of this is clear rational thinking, but this is not clear rational thinking, but he's too invested and he can't possibly accept it. V'yifin parav yavol beito v'lo shat li bo gam lazot v'yichperu kol mitzrayim sevivota ya'or mayim l'shtot ki lo yichu l'shtot mimea ya'or. So they go digging wells looking for water because they have no water to drink. So as I said, this is quite annoying. Next. But yet Aaron et Yado on the main Mitzrayim, but Tal Hatzvardeya but Ilchas et Eretz Mitzrayim. The second one, and by the way, despite Moshe being told to take his, the first three all performed by Aaron. The rest of them, the next six will be by Moshe, and the tenth one, of course, Makor Bechor. It sounds that way, but at the end, Aaron does it. We skip that part. The first three will be done by Aaron. The next six will be done by Moshe, and the final one will be done by God himself, which is the one that we mentioned in the Haggadah, because ultimately that's the one that led us free. When God says that you went free, right, lo yadei shaliach, lo yadei malach, lo yadei seraf, but there is a shaliach, but that's not the one that set us free. That's the tenth one, that's Makat Bechorot. So over here again in source number 4, Vayet Aaron et Yado Mimei Mitzrayim. So again, it's the water of Egypt which is rebelling against the Egyptians. It is now the frogs which are going to come out of the water. And they're able to do the exact same thing. Vayalu Atzvardim Al Eretz Mitzrayim. Vayikur Paro L'Moshe L'Aron Vayomer Hatiru El Hashem, which is great. Notice which name he uses. Yudke Vavke. Pray to God. That this verse is an unbelievable admission on Paro's part. Pray to God, which God? Yud Kei Vav Kei. V'yatiru el Hashem. V'yaser atzvardim mimenu mi'ami. V'ashlachat l'am v'yizvchu l'Hashem. So Paro says it twice in one verse. Recognizing there's a God, recognizing that God is in control, and recognizing that the Jews have a desire or a need to pray to God. V'yom ha'paro l'moshe. It's pa'ero lai l'matai atir l'cha. So what's the time? It's going to happen tomorrow, and then this should be absolute proof that there is this one all-powerful God. The next plague that takes place, there's no warning, which is why I can't read to you the whole warning that takes place. The next one is going to be Kinim. How does Kinim take place? It says that the kinim, all the afar, produces the kinim. Now, last week, my mother said something that you didn't hear. She said she didn't like that the word vayishritzu was used regarding the way that the Jews were multiplying. So that's part of, you know, the basic anti-Semitic, going all the way to Goebbels and the Nazis, that the Jews multiply like vermin in the Jews, and that's what they saw as well. So this third plague, which again, keep in mind, the third plague is a punishment for the first two plagues. Third plague is on their body. It's not just there's no water. Now it attacks them personally, right? The same with the sixth plague, would be boils, attacks their body personally. So this plague perhaps is connected, because it says it uses the word afar, it comes out of the afar. The Jews are already told that they're going to be kafar haaretz, they're going to multiply. So therefore, it could be a direct midah keneged midah, that you're upset with the way that the Jews have multiplied, by yishritzu, and you called the Jews, sheretz, what's a sheretz?
Vermin.
So now what happens, midah keneged midah, they get struck, the afar now gets turned into kinim, and they get struck by kinim. So what I'm just saying is that it may be, again, this is punishment. This is not as much of a theological issue as much as this is punishment. But there's something else which happened over here that we need to pay attention to. But first, I want to read what happens in the text itself. Source number 5, drugs are also one of the symbols in Egypt. But I said that it's almost too easy to get these false positives. You see frog faces on some of their, I forgot what you call it, yeah. Yeah. What? Yeah, hieroglyphics. And the frog was something which was also one. Yeah, it's one of the symbols. Yeah, it's one of the symbols there as well. Now reading. Yeah.
It could be that the dot of blood is an only determined symbol. It's both an act against the god, but it's also you feed the babies into the river. It's blood. You don't swear.
Right. We can't ignore that, and that is eventually going to come back to the splitting of the sea when they're all going to die in as well. But that's really what God says, B'nei B'chori Yisrael. And but it's also connected to the Makat B'chorot, which is 9. Again, a punishment which is personal, where the firstborn die. So therefore, Israel's my firstborn. If you kill them, I'm going to kill you. So you're going to have a number of these things taking place in terms of God's moral outrage at the Egyptians having killed the Jewish males. So one is going to be, in terms of the Nile itself, turning to blood, because that's what you've done. You've turned the Nile into blood. But secondly, in terms of your firstborn is going to die, and finally now you're going to die in water as well. So I'm saying there's going to be a whole bunch of things with water along the way. So it's not just the theological arguments that Paro sees himself as a god, but it's also the punishment for what the Egyptians have done. And that leads us to source number 5. V'yasu chayin achar tumim. What chayin? This is lice, right? It's as if we haven't had enough of them. Let's go see if we can get a little bit more. So I also find this amusing. V'yasu chayin achar tumim balateim lotziya takinim v'lo yuchlu. But this they couldn't do. V'tiya kina ba'adam uveima, and the kinim were all over the place. They were by people, animals, just all over the place. This is the one plague which still exists today in Israel. Yeah.
It's interesting. What it couldn't do is create life.
So that's what we have to get to, is what exactly took place over here. Vayomru chartumim, and the chartumim then say something, El Paro. They say, Etzpa Elokim hi. Vechazak leif paro velo shema aleim kashir diber Hashem. Now, the first time we read this, and maybe the second time, and the fifth time, and the tenth time we read this, we see this as an admission on their part that we're just outflanked, we can't do this, and so on and so forth. I'm not convinced that's what they said, I'm not convinced it's what they meant, and I'm certainly not convinced it's what Paro heard. So that's one of these interesting things about communication. We say things, but are we judged by what we say, or we judge what somebody hears? The first thing that we notice is that they say, oh, this is the hand of God, but they didn't quite say hand, they said finger.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a downgrade compared to what God had said earlier, and again we'll say later by other makot, that Yad Hashem is going to come after them. But the other thing, which you can't ignore, is the name of God which is used. Previously, we saw, pray to Hashem, Yudke Vavke, go serve Hashem, Yudke Vavke. What did they mean, and what did Paro hear when they say, Etzba Elokim. So, and did they say Etzba Elokim, or did they say Etzba Elohim? And part of what I'm asking right now is, did they say it with what we would put a capital G, because they're referring to God, creator and sustainer of the universe, the Almighty, right? The name Elohim would be the Almighty. Or is this one of the various gods around? What exactly did they say? And my guess is as follows. Okay, let's put this into context here. First of all, they are wise men, sorcerers, magicians, but they work. They have a boss, and their boss is Paro. And Paro may not be the easiest boss because he's a tyrant. And you have to be very careful what you say to him. What I'm about to say, I think, has a lot of impact just in terms of general business practices and people who have people that work for them. If you have somebody who works for you, are they able to tell you the truth? Are they able to tell you the truth, or will they get in trouble for telling you the truth? Can they stand up and say, listen, I have a friend who's a CEO of a large company, and I learn with him once a week on the phone, and I asked him this question. I said, can people who work for you tell you? So I said, what do they tell you? He said, they tell me what I want to hear. So he goes, that's why I pay them. I said, you should fire them, because you could tell yourself what you want to. You could take their salary. What do you need them for? But I said, how easy, you know, what kind of atmosphere is it, is created? Do people, if something's going wrong, do they only say the things which the boss needs to hear, or wants to hear, or do they have the ability to stand up and say, listen, this is what's really going on over here? See, I think that you see some very interesting yes men over here, and they've covered themselves wonderfully. How do they cover themselves? That no matter what the outcome is going to be afterwards, they'll say, well, we said that. Because they left it in a very power of way. They left it, this is Etzba Elokim, this is the finger of God. Well, which God are they talking about? Are they talking about God, or are they talking about one of these various gods of Egypt? Let's investigate a little bit, but what's the response going to be from Paro? V'yichzek lev Paro v'lo shama aleihem kasher diber Hashem. So they Paro's response is that his heart is strengthened again, which doesn't surprise us because this happens all the time. Let's take a look at source number 9. But again, it depends. They said it in a way that they can afterwards say, what are you talking about? Right? Like lawyers, right? I hear it completely, but let's take a look at some of the commentaries. Source number 9, the Rashbam. Etzba Elokim hu, what does it mean? Makat midina. V'lo yideim shel elu haita. This, what does it mean, midina? So this sounds like he's saying that this is some kind of a natural phenomena. Look at the Ibn Ezra in 10. This makah has nothing to do with the Jews. That's just a fascinating interpretation. Where is he getting this from? He's getting it from the words Etzba Elohim. Rak makat Elohim hi. It's a natural process took place. Now, what in the world happened here that can possibly make him think that it was a natural phenomena as opposed to some kind of miraculous event? Because it wasn't warned, precisely. There was no warning over here. No, but before that, there's no warning over here. There's no warning. The one who spells that out is going to be the Netziv in Source 15. Etzba Elokim hu marahi al eza davar aval enu b'torat onesha Yisrael shere lo haya b'zeh hatra'a v'gam enu makah gedola kokach. You know, relatively to everything else, okay? There's a lice infestation. But the lack of warning over here opened up the door for... Yeah, for I want to use the word denial because whatever. Right? It opened up the door for Paro to be able to say, oh, this is just, or that's what they're saying. It's Etzba Elohim. So that's interesting. He's hearing them say not Etzba Elohim, he's hearing them say Etzba Elohim. And Ibn Ezra, who has a soft spot for astrology, says, oh no, this was supposed to happen. Now, this was a natural process. When you go back and look at the Rashbam again, you realize the Rashbam had said the same thing also. When the Rashbam said, Makat midina, v'lo yedehim shalelu. It was something midin, midin adin. It was nature. It was something which took place over here, but this was not a punishment in the sense that God had sent somebody. But I'm going to say this again. What gave them the ability to come to this type of an idea?
And that, just one more second.
And that's because there was no warning over here. So, how do you define a miracle? What's the most important thing in a miracle? Right? Okay, here, I'll help you. A miracle is like a joke. The most important thing is timing, right? You have to say the joke right before people laugh. Otherwise, it doesn't work. The same thing is true in terms of a miracle. A miracle is something extremely unlikely happening, but it's the timing. The timing is significant, which means when you go around Jericho 7 times and you blow the shofar and then the walls come down, that's what makes it a miracle. They finally found some evidence that the wall, for years and years, if you don't know this, in terms of biblical archaeology, for years and years and years and years, there was this woman, Catherine Kenyon, who claimed that there was absolutely no, the whole biblical story is wrong because there was no, there was no wall by Jericho. She excavated there and couldn't find it. By the way, just between us, don't tell anybody else, she refused to come to Israel after 1967. She kept on writing articles because it was occupied territory, so she kept on writing and publicizing, but there was never a wall. Except for one problem. 3 or 4 miles from where she looked, they found an excavation, they found a wall. So not only did they find a wall, they found also the walls that had fallen in instead of fallen, fallen out, which is, if battering rams come in, so then they get knocked in, but they found the walls had fallen the other way. So the New York Times had an article, it was in Biblical Archaeology Review, the New York Times article read something to the effect that believers score in the Battle of Jericho. But then there was a picture, and there was the article said that scientists theorized that an earthquake came and knocked down the wall. And that's why the walls fell in that direction. And they also found there was food inside. Because normally when cities are destroyed, there's no food left. You surround the city. You wait for all the food to be gone. You wait for everyone to get weak. And then you just walk in and you kill everybody there, anybody who's not dead yet. But here they found food and they found that the walls were the other way. So they said, oh, it's obviously there was an earthquake. Okay, I'm fine with an earthquake. If the earthquake happens right after you blow the shofar, right, that's exactly the point. So I'll say it again. The key thing about a miracle, yeah, this could be a lice infestation. That happens every now and again. But the point over here is that when God said it, now, God said it to Moshe and Aaron, God didn't say it to Paro. Paro, we're on a need-to-know basis. Paro does not need to know everything. And this, he was not told. And that's what gave him the ability to withstand this particular plague where he and they were all punished personally by the lice is because there was no warning. It's not a miracle. It's a natural thing. Etzbe Elohim, and therefore Elohim, and therefore what Paro is hearing over here, he's hearing his people telling him that this is natural. Incidentally, I just want to read one thing and then the second thing and we'll take your comment and we'll stop. There's a book in Source 19 which is called Gan Na'ul. I normally don't go here or because this is pretty far. This is written by Rav Avram Abulafia, one of the most prominent Kabbalists, Abulafia. Aval b'kinim v'yasu kin ha'chartumim b'latayim, lo tzit ha'kinim v'lo yachlu. By the way, I get to these things because I'm looking for something very specific. And if he's the only one who talks about it, but I know what I'm looking for. I'll just explain it that way. You'll see. Aval, where is the word Etzbe Elohim used other than this case? It's also used by the writing of the Luchot. So that's what interested me, is what can the possible connection be between Etzbe Elohim here and Etzbe Elohim there. So, Aval Hodu Ba'al Korcham Shezo Einu Mimin HaKshafiot Shelahem. This wasn't their magic. Ach Amur Etzbe Elohim Hi. Remez L'Sod HaLuchot. And this is connected to the Luchot. Shenem Ba'am K'tuvim Be'Etzbe Elohim. I mean, and he correctly, I mean, that's what I was searching for, and this is one of the very few sources that notes the connection. Shagam humi min haniflaota elokiot. This is also the hand of God. So that's interesting, is that the pasuk before the Sarita Dibrod is, Vaydeber Elokim et kol dumei lelemor. Rashi says, why Elokim? Because God is a judge, and God is going to judge on these particular things. So Rabbi Soloveitchik, in a famous, very long lecture he gave on that, the Rashi on that verse, his introduction to Sarita Dibrod, and he raised the question, what this Rashi means. Is this a question, such a thing as natural law, right? Natural law is, for example, gravity. Can I say, I deny natural law. I jump out of the window, but I deny gravity. How is that going to work out for you? Right? You can't deny, well, maybe short-term basis. You can very micro. It's, yeah, so far so good, right? It doesn't work out well. You can't deny natural law. So Rabbi Soloveitchik suggested that perhaps the Luchot, Aseret HaDibrot, V'deber Elokim, Etzba Elokim, maybe it's telling you that this is actually natural law. We don't always see it. We don't always understand it. And we can deny it just like Paro denies it, or the his Chartumim deny it. But it could very well be that the understanding is that if you create a society where there's murder and where there's adultery and where there's a lack of respect for parents and where they don't keep Shabbat and so on, that natural law, we don't see it, but natural law will destroy that society. So that's one of the possibilities that he suggested. So I'll say the fact that he didn't talk about the Etzba Elokim, but the fact that Etzba Elokim is used in both, perhaps that leads you in that direction. Continue in the Rav Avraham Abulafia here. And he says, Remez l'soda luchot, shagam he was also, v'sheva makot ha'nisharot, lo nizkeru achar tumim, shichshavu l'dmut polotayim l'polot ha'neviyim ha'eluhiyim, aval shatku v'amdu mishtomimim v'sovlim ha'makot kishar ha'am, v'nemar b'makah ha'shishit shehi ha'shchin, v'lo yichu achar tumim l'amod l'fnei Moshe m'nei ha'shchin, ki haya ha'shchin b'char tumim u'v'chol Mitzrayim. So it's very interesting. The Chartumim lose their jobs after this. They still stand there, but they have nothing to say. They've been put out. Their inability at this point also put them out of jobs, but they stand there. And significantly, when are they struck? Well, the third and the sixth. I mean, this goes back to our thing. So, but the sixth one is that they get struck again. Why? So I think there is perhaps some kind of poetic license. What did you wish to say? Exactly. And they lose their jobs. And that's what's really good. Source 12, and I guess this will be it for today, 12. The Malbim. Vayomur chatumim oparo etzba Elohim hu kishetir'e b'kol ha'parshiyot ha'ela lo tinser shaparova mitzrim yikru'u at Hashem b'shem Elohim rak b'shem havaya. He said, notice what I pointed out before, that Paro was talking about Yudke, even though he denied knowledge, he was talking about Yudke Vavke. So what happened to, why is this Elohim over here? That when they use the word Elohim, he's claiming that at least Paro definitely understands he's not talking about God. They're not talking about God, or they should have said Yud Kei Vav Kei. It is the finger of God, Yud Kei Vav Kei. O Etzba Elohei Yisrael, the God of Israel. Ki makazeh ba below hatra'a. Again, because it came without any warning. Chashvu shelo ba me'et Elokei Yisrael b'shvil Yisrael. It didn't come. She'im kena yatzarech lodia zot l'moshe, v'shemoshe yitra bo t'chila. Should have warned them earlier. That they thought that this was one of the powers of Egypt that had struck them. Now, by the way, you can start wondering now, but why would the power of Egypt be striking Paro, and isn't Paro all power of Egypt? But essentially what they're doing over here, you know, okay, there's bad karma, there's bad stuff going on, but this has nothing to do with these Jews, nothing to do with these slaves, nothing to do with Moshe and Aaron. And I'm going to come back and say it again, the biggest evidence over here is the fact that there was no warning. So let's go back and recap and just see what we've seen. There is a process here within the Makot. The larger goal over here is that God is going to show his dominance and God is going to show that he's all-powerful. And my suspicion is the Jews need to see this as much as the Egyptians need to see this. Part of being enslaved for all this time is that you begin to believe in the culture that you live in. And they need to be freed from that culture. Absolutely. Right. They need to train from Stockholm Syndrome to Jerusalem Syndrome. Correct. So they need to believe in redemption. So the plagues themselves go into these groups of threes. The first one go to the Nile, and the Nile is going to get struck, and the second one is going to be in terms of their possessions and more in the house and more, again, a little different. And the third one is going to be a punishment for the first two. Paro never understood that third one is the punishment because that actually gives him a way out. Now, giving the way out provides something very valuable. And what is that? It gives him the excuse to continue on, which means that allows him to get to the fourth one, which means Otherwise, he may have wanted to stop. So over here, his good advisors, by telling him it's not, you know, what it really is, they misread the map. They say it in a very powerful way, but afterwards, no matter what happens, they go, well, that's what we said, right? It's Elohim, that we said that. So therefore, these good advisors are sitting on the fence, and they think that this is going to help them keep their jobs, but they don't keep their jobs, but it gives power enough power to be able to continue on. So essentially all they did was they got power, some more punishment, which I don't know if anybody here is particularly upset with, but they thought they would be keeping the jobs. They lose their jobs. They're going to say again, ironically, when do we find them again? We find them again by the sixth one, where they get hit again. Now, just within this larger process over here, and that is ultimately in order to show that God is more powerful, at the same time, in order to get the punishments, this process will be played out until we finally get to the last one, which I guess we have to save something for next week, until we get to the last three of the plagues. But I'll say it once again. Already before the first plague, there was one sign, and that sign was really enough. That sign of power was capable of really have some humility, and it's not just humility, having some insight to be able to look and to see what just now happened. That first one, if I'm not mistaken, where the staff of Aaron swallows all the other staffs, turned crocodiles, turns to staff again, was all that we needed to know. That gave the message of everything that's going to take place afterwards, but Paro could not accept that, and that's what allowed him to get the first plague. And he couldn't accept that because, again, the Nile is stabbed, but they also were able to do it, so that allows him to get the second one. So, but they're able to make more frogs? Okay, so now he can get the third one, which means each time he's denying something, he's just denying in order to be able to get more punishment, and at the same time, equally important, for God be able to show the Jews how God's dominion is in every possible way. And along the way, we note that the more we understand of Egyptian mythology, including the crocodile, including the Nile, including the frogs, including the sun god, that's all for next week, including the sun god, yes, the last three plagues all take place in darkness. The sun god is eclipsed in all of those last three plagues. The sun god is not no longer there, right, when it comes, right? So at that point, Paro essentially has nothing left to say. I mean, if you want me to add one more statement about this, the final action is the destruction of the firstborn, and the firstborn was essentially the symbol of Egypt. Egypt believed that every family had the firstborn. That firstborn was powerful. That firstborn was the boss in the family, and that firstborn was served by the other people of the family. This is what created a slave society, where the other people in the family needed people to do things for them. Everybody had somebody doing something for someone, except for the slaves, who were at the very bottom. So therefore, the visual of this kind of a society, where Paro is the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn, is a pyramid. That's exactly the point. The pyramid is a symbol of this dominance of the firstborn. So there, because the firstborn sits on the shoulders of all the others in the family. Each Paro is the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn, which places him on top of this pyramid, being supported by all the other people in Egypt, and then on the bottom being supported by the slaves, who are the ones who are, in fact, building it. Maybe there's one more message that I'll say, which I heard in the name of Dr. Josh Berman. He noticed when we get to the sixth plague, what was the sixth one? Shchin, boils. How was it done? It says that they actually use the furnace. They go to the furnace and they take ash out of the furnace and they throw the ash, Moshe throws the ash into the heavens and then it boils, comes down, and that's the punishment. That's what strikes them. So there may be a message over here as well. So first, we just have to think about furnaces. So I say furnaces, and you're all going to tell me Avram thrown in the furnace, which is wonderful, except we all know one thing. It doesn't actually say that in the Chumash. But where is furnaces actually mentioned in the Chumash? Furnaces are mentioned in the context of building. Of building what? The tower? The bricks. You need the furnaces to make the bricks. The furnaces, the kivshan, is a really big oven, industrial-sized oven, which is how you make bricks. So now, over here, the Jews are the ones who were building, the Jews are the ones who were making bricks. In order to be making bricks, once again, you need a furnace. So what's interesting about this particular thing, Moshe goes and takes ash. So how do you get ash out of a furnace? A furnace is really hot. So what does this now mean? It means the furnace hasn't been working. It's off. The furnace is off. which means by the time we've gotten to the sixth plague, the Egyptians are so preoccupied with all of the suffering they're going through, they have no time to, at this point, to be allowing themselves to be forcing the Jews into slavery, and for Moshe to be able to walk into the furnace, take out a little ash, and throw it in front of Paro, and say, here, watch. That's already saying that the slavery has come to an end. That's already, again, a message that slavery is over. But and I love what he said. And, you know, he's a friend of mine. I haven't get to tell him. I just heard somebody quote him. I love what he said, but I'm going to say it again. We can't look at all of these things just in terms of the facts, what actually happened. We need to understand the symbols of what are being used, that within the symbols, a whole other world emerges, and that's the world that Paro lived in, and that's the world that's going to be destroyed.